This is The Cable.
Big bid on 10-year treasuries over the last week.
Tech story is front and centre.
A lot of people are saying, no thank you, step back. You're saying, get in, why?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
The dollar a little bit stronger today.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable.
An historic moment from which there can be no turning back.
With Jonathan Ferro and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Good afternoon to the City of London, live across the capital on DAB Digital Radio. Alongside Guy Johnson, I'm Jonathan Ferro. You are listening to The Cable. What a week it has been in this very messy equity market. Charlie Pettit, the top stories.
Here's what's going on in terms of markets. We have got Daimler issuing its second profit warning in 4 months, blaming expenses relating to accusations of diesel cheating and the cost of replacing air conditioning refrigerant on older cars. Shares down the most intraday in more than 2 years after the German maker of Mercedes-Benz cars said group earnings before interest and taxes will be significantly below market expectations. Daimler is down by about 2%. China's economic growth slowed more than expected in the third quarter as weak industrial output data and, quote, the severe international situation challenged the government's efforts to stabilize the economy and reach its growth targets. Facebook has hired Nick Clegg, Britain's former deputy prime minister, to run its global lobbying efforts as governments around the world debate how best to regulate the social media giant. Latest from the news desk, Jonathan Ferro. Happy Friday, back to you.
I don't think I've ever done that, Charlie Pellet. Throw to an anchor that's not there because I didn't know they were in or not.
And what's even more amazing is in an era with so much technology, yeah, with video hookups where you can always see where your anchor is.
I tell you, I don't know where to start.
Yeah, exactly.
Charlie Pellet, I'll be back with you in about 28 minutes. I'm going to get it together. We begin with our top story. Rome and Brussels clashing as the European Commission rejects the Italian government's proposed budget. Some economists out there, though, think the budget makes sense. One of those is Deutsche Bank chief economist David Folkarts-Landau. Take a listen.
I believe that what Italy needs is it needs to jumpstart the economy. We need to stop talking about more reforms, more fiscal stringency. It's just a matter now of jumpstarting the economy. So to make 2.4 the end-all, be-all is a mistake. I believe that they have all the rights in the world to go through 2.4, and in fact, they will go through 2.4.
That was the EU's, that was the David Folkarts-Landau view from Deutsche Bank. Here's the view from the EU budget chief, Pierre Moscovici, saying the ball is in Italy's court now. He sent a letter to Rome calling its spending plans excessive and asking for an explanation. Then he came out today with a bit more of a conciliatory tone, basically saying that he didn't want to get involved in the economic policies of Italy. So I'm trying to sort of make the most of what's going on and try and understand it. Marcus Ashworth joins us, Bloomberg opinion columnist, and Cameron Christ, macro strategist for Bloomberg, joins us as well. Marcus, what's going on?
Well, I think the EU have got a bit frit. Moscovici has realised that perhaps this isn't the cleverest thing to do to force the spread between, for instance, Italian government bonds over Germany to 400, as unfortunately Salvini had said it would never get to, and was looking like it was racing up towards. It got to about 340, and they decided maybe this isn't the cleverest thing to push it right here, right now. Do they really want to have all battles raging at once? And at the same time, there is a very interesting weekend cabinet meeting between the two erstwhile partners of the current Italian government, who are looking askance at each other, because the five-star movement are very unhappy with, yeah, what the League have got up to with regards to some jiggity-pokery on the various different tax changes that they're
going through. Which raises the question, Cameron, who's the biggest fight right now? The fight between the Commission and Italy, or the Italians between themselves?
Well, I'm going to break a little bit of news here. There's an article in Il Foglio.
Okay.
Which is an
You're going to translate for us.
An Italian. No, I'm not, but the good people at Google are.
Wonderful.
Which suggests that maybe the government will step down to 2.1% for the deficit target. But let's take a step back here and consider the source of Europe's distaste, a certain Monsieur Moscovici, who, when finance minister of France a few years ago, never managed to produce a budget deficit that was smaller than 3.9% of France's GDP. So the hypocrisy from our friend Mr. Moscovici is little short of breathtaking.
Yep.
And I've got a lot of sympathy, and indeed I've written to this effect, with Mr. or Herr Folkarts-Landau, that
you're
listen,
not, you're not
Italy,
alone.
Italy has tried austerity for years now. And you know what? It hasn't worked. So, you know, what's the, you know, Einstein probably apocryphally, but famously said that the definition of insanity is trying the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
Yeah.
Austerity hasn't, in fact, helped with the stock of debt in Italy. You know what? Maybe a little growth just might do so. And a little fiscal laxity to jumpstart the economy might just be what the doctor ordered.
I had a guest on earlier that said, I agree with 50% of what David Folkhartslander just said. The other 50%, though, I would say this, that it's the Germans that need to loosen the purse string and do something on the budget.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's absurd, little short of absurd, that Germany, which runs this massive current account surplus, which is indicative not only of a competitive advantage for their exports, but also a paucity of domestic demand, is the finance minister is basically bragging about how they're going to keep reducing Germany's debt as a percentage of GDP by running budget surpluses. It's absurd. And let's go back 15 years ago when the whole stability and growth pact first came into being. Remember, I'm old enough, and I assume Marcus is as well. You are probably still in short pants here at this point, when it was just a stability pact. But guess what? Germany's growth wasn't strong enough. They were the sick man of Europe, and suddenly that stability pact became the stability and growth pact. So Germany could break the 3% budget deficit limit. France could break the 3% budget deficit limit 15 years ago. So it's the hypocrisy from Brussels and the elites is quite breathtaking.
Marcus,
I'd love to square the circle here and say what the other bits that this delightful chief economist from Deutsche Bank said, which that Britain would do wonderfully outside the European Union.
I just threw that one in there.
Yes, the hypocrisy is indeed very large here, and I think what's going on in Europe is indicative of why perhaps that maybe there are other alternatives, and indeed sticking to a single currency and indeed a single interest rate in this particular environment.
Perhaps why
with different types of economic outlooks doesn't necessarily always make sense.
Perhaps why the Europeans don't want to make it an alternative.
Although one might observe from the peanut gallery that Britain was never subject to these sort of budget constraints by virtue of exercising its right to remain outside of the single currency. So that,
not the European Union, though.
I completely agree that the stunning hypocrisy from Brussels in this instance is sort of meat and drink for the Brexit argument. And this particular manifestation of it really doesn't apply to Britain.
Nothing but a bit of fuel for the Brexiteers.
Slightly disagree on that
last
point.
Marcus. There you go.
Well, I just think that the point is that the European Union construct and what it's going and what it's trying to do is we seem to agree very much on certain point, but not on the other side. So, let's leave it for another time. But they are definite things which don't all join up together in the middle, should we say.
We can do it next if you want. Marcus Ashworth sticking with me. Bloomberg opinion columnist and Cameron Kreis, macro strategist for Bloomberg. Another automaker in a bit of trouble. This time it's Daimler cutting its profit forecast for the rest of the year. That conversation up next. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferrow and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
We are ex-Guy Johnson this Friday. I'm Jonathan Ferrow, live across the Capitol.
Does that mean you used to be Guy Johnson, but now you're
well,
back to being
Well, we as a
Ferrow?
Team, yeah, we
oh,
were
you mean excluding,
Guy Johnson.
Excluding Guy Johnson.
Excluding Guy Johnson. Do you get where I'm going with this
now,
Cameron?
I mean,
I'm happy to fill in the dots, you know, just fill in the gaps
well,
for you.
All right. Modern society, you never know.
Live across the Capitol. I don't know where this is going. On DAB Digital Radio, this is Bloomberg Radio. Marcus, another automaker. In fact, I think this is the second time that Daimler's had to do this. The parent company, Mercedes-Benz. A second profit warning in 4 months?
Oh, it's Brexit, isn't it? Oh, no, sorry, pardon me.
Apparently it's not.
Or it's China, then. Or it's the trade wars. Whatever it is. Look, these...
Or it's replacing air conditioning refrigerant in older cars.
The diesel crisis goes on, and that's something which I think has catching up with a lot of the German automakers. it's just taken a while to come through, and when all these things happen, they always come at once. So, yeah, look, there's a bunch of things they need to get their act together again. The dividend not clearly is in threat here, and I think it's not just the Daimler story. It's VW as well, and indeed Beamer. So, look, you know, this is something which isn't great, but you know, this is test me to an economy which is changing, and they're not reacting quickly enough, and that's why, you know, the auto potential automakers of the future spot an opportunity, and it depends how quickly the old behemoths react, but yeah, you know, it's something which I think we'll see a lot more of.
It does bring up the Brexit issue, though, in one way, Marcus. It seems to be really tough for an automaker right now. China is not doing well. That was the big growth market for a long, long time for some of these brands. And you just wonder whether this complicates the ability of the Europeans to really be tough with the UK when it's such a big market for German autos.
Well, they rolled over straight away when the US got busy on this, which I think gave a clue to a few of us anyway about quite where the weaknesses are. So they have been extraordinarily quiet when it comes to Brexit, but it's a major market, major market for them. But for instance, just anecdotally, you go into Mercedes-Benz dealership. Sadly, I have to do quite a lot, or my wife has to, because ours constantly keeps on breaking down for electrics. But that's by the by. That you cannot buy a Mercedes-Benz or a BMW or an Audi these days unless it's a diesel, because they are trying to get rid of their old stock. And it's something which is, funny enough, when you see back and look into the stats on sales in the UK have dropped sharply. That's because they're trying to get rid of their old stock. So it's a old stock, old story argument, which they're trying to get the head of themselves. And there's going to be another year or so of this. I think they know what they've got to do. I think these guys are smart. They're clever businessmen. They're just going to have to take a little bit of heat the next year or so to get themselves over was essentially a EU-led diktat, which was that diesel is good, therefore make lots of diesel. Diesel went cheaper, and they cut the tax on it, certainly in this country, and therefore it led to a huge boom in diesel sales. All of a sudden, we're having to wean ourselves off it. You speak to people in the street or the pub or in the whatever, no one will touch or even buy another diesel car again. And that's what's caught these guys out.
Cameron?
Frankly, I'm surprised that Tesla isn't up on this.
Tesla's right? Down for different reasons today.
Yes, well, but it only takes a single grain of potentially positive news normally for the Tesla bull crowd to get running. But, you know, insofar as some of this is this function of this apparently increasingly outdated propulsion technology of diesel engines, you would have thought that the natural alternative, or the next alternative, the electric car market, would be a natural beneficiary. And you, taking a step back, and I hate to bring this back to Tesla, which it always seems to be, Tesla's always bragging about how, you know, they've already got a majority of the luxury car market in the U.S. Well, where do they go from there? I mean, if you've already got most of the market, where's the growth hub?
You're a growth company talking about saturation.
Yeah, exactly.
Something's not right there. Cameron Kreiss and Marcus Ashworth sticking with me. Next up on the program, China soothing the calming nerves of some investors out there. That's next. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferro and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Guy Johnson will be very upset that he missed this little tune.
Yeah, the Proclaimers.
Do you like that?
Is that a new entrant on the cable's musical list?
A new entrance
list?
In the charts on the cable. Come back a few
times. 1992 all over again.
Is that when it was?
I believe so, yeah.
Was it? You've got a great memory of it, wasn't it?
Well, funny enough, I was studying, I did a term in Glasgow in 92, and I think that's when the song was popular.
I'm Googling it now to just find out. But, you know, you may well be right.
I seem to remember it when I was in Glasgow.
The charts in 1992 with I'm Gonna Be.
500 Miles.
Yeah, the Proclaimers. There's some knowledge, Cameron Kreiss. I'm really impressed. What was the Chinese GDP print today? Do you remember that?
6.5% year on year, 6.4 quarter on quarter.
Bit of deceleration there, Marcus Ashworth. Your thoughts?
Well, indeed, I think that we all know that Chinese GDP data is highly valuable information. It gives us an awful
you know, so, a lot. And an economist inside. On the show today, Marcus,
we
you'll love this.
On that
this
one.
Economist came on the show this morning, won't name him, and he turns around and he said, China's really good at getting the GDP print out very quickly, ahead of everyone else.
It's done a quarter before, isn't it?
Yeah, I seem to remember in like 2008... they released full year GDP like on December 25th or something, on Christmas or something like that. Yeah, like before the year was even over. Like, here's what it is.
I remember them cutting rates on Christmas Day as well. Marcus, go on.
But to be fair to them, they have the ability to ratchet their GDP up and down because they have a command economy, in the context that they can pump up with the credit growth or dial it down as they see fit. And at the moment, actually, relatively speaking, they've been trying to take it out of the economy, and that they are very happy, I think, to see this slide to 6.5, test the waters. They will still beat their 6.5 target for the whole year of 2018. So this is just testing the waters. Next year, you'll see it dial down to maybe 6.25 or something. They know they need to take the steam out of the economy. They know they need to slow down their credit growth. It's all part of a very carefully orchestrated program. Nonetheless, they have a real issue with their stock market. And if you look at stocks which are sort of outside of some of the bigger, obviously controlled major state-owned companies, the effect of the trade war is really hitting hard. So yeah. Whatever you think of Donald Trump, his approach to the trade prospects with China is having a real impact on China stocks, and it's clear that retail flows they're all exiting out, and that's going to has at some point to have an attitude change, one would imagine, from Xi Jinping. But from what I understand, even though we're not getting it in the headlines, there's an awful lot of work going on behind the scenes with both the US and Chinese officials. And I suspect, you know, maybe I've been a bit cynical here, November 6th is coming up. There might be something coming out before then. Who
Perhaps,
knows?
Yeah. We've got a G20 meeting at the end of November as well. I'd love to know what would happen in developed markets, Cameron, if, like the Chinese overnight, we had the securities watchdog, the central bank, and the banking and insurance regulator all come out at the same time and tell people to calm down.
Well, Asia's great. I love Asia.
Nothing to see here.
I love Asia. After the Japanese bubble burst in beginning of 1990, the Japanese government used to engage what was colloquially known as price-keeping operations, which was a riff on UN peacekeeping operations, where they'd come in and they'd enroll their stooges to basically buy Japanese stocks to sort of support the market. Hong Kong did the same thing in 97, or the HKMA literally came out and bought stocks. Excuse me. And in China, it's known not as price-keeping operations, but as the national team, where they get, again...
I love that.
Yeah, which is, it's kind of cute.
We on the sidelines call it the plunge protection team.
Yes, here in the States, it's the plunge protection team, right? And you know, you might think of the national team as the footy team.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In China, it's the national sport, famously is sort of gambling or what have you. At least that's the popular perception. And plunging in the stock market, plunging these days being the operative word. Yeah. And so, yes, the authorities have come out issuing calming, soothing, balming words to hopefully temper the pessimism of the retail noodle-selling stock trading punter. And presumably they will also enroll some financial wherewithal to throw a few bids in as well. Now, what I would say is I'm a little less sanguine than Marcus that they're in control of the economy. It seems evident to me that they've been loosening the purse strings in terms of the flow of credit over the last few months.
How do you de-lever and loosen the purse strings at the same time?
Well, you de-lever, you watch the economy slow pretty dramatically, and then
so you got
They're in the dangerous spot where the trend GDP has fallen quite sharply, simply because as they move up the value chain, which they've done a lot of, the easiest productivity gains are behind us, and also the labor force is no longer growing as it was before, and indeed will soon start to shrink thanks to the demographic pyramid in China. So trend GDP growth is slowing. You know, it's probably not even 6.5 anymore. So to some extent, they have to.
If it ever was.
Sorry. Well, no, it clearly was a decade ago, 12 years ago.
I love how it clearly was. A decade
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, well, yeah, but it's, you know,
no,
that's
you.
When the
Clearly
productivity
was.
Gains were.
But I was expecting
very,
you to
very...
say like a couple of years ago.
No, a decade ago. Yeah. And I think you have to look at China kind of like you would look at banks a decade ago, marking some of the credit derivatives on their books. They, you know, they have a decent idea where true value might be, but they can mark them as they see fit. Depending
or
on,
like all European banks, level 3 assets even today.
yes, that's a not terrible analogy.
Guys, it's been great to catch up with you both. I wish we could do this for a couple more
hours.
We should
do it at the pub sometime.
We should actually, honestly,
exactly.
This show should be done at the pub.
I couldn't agree more.
Guy's buying.
You know, Guy is buying. I think we can just sort of throw everything at Guy now. Where is Guy? Nobody told me. Where is Guy?
As long as he's around November 5th, I'll have to worry about him.
Do you know where Guy is, Cameron? No one knows where Guy is.
Yeah, maybe he's queuing for tickets at the Olympic Stadium.
Maybe he is. Big game. Spurs.
Yeah, I know.
Spurs.
Yeah, I know.
Big game. Good luck
Thank
to
you.
The Hammers.
Thank
it's
you.
The team of the cable. You're listening to the cable. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferrow and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Live across the capital. On DAB Digital Radio, you are listening to Bloomberg Radio. Guy Johnson's disappeared. I'm going to ask my producer, is he back on Monday? Is he? He's not back on Monday. Okay. Equities flat in America on the S&P 500, positive 0.09%. We were much higher than that earlier on in the session. The FTSE 100 does close positive, up by around about a third of 1%. To bring the price action in the FX market, the euro firmer against the weaker dollar. Euro dollar up by a half of 1%. The euro getting a lift after some conciliatory tones from the European Commissioner Moscovici a little bit earlier. So the euro firmer in the bond market. Italian bonds get a bit. Italian 10-year. The yield was much higher earlier. It's now much lower. It's down by 20 basis points on the session. The Italian 10-year now south of 350 after being close to 375 a little bit earlier. In fact, we were at 380 earlier on in the day. So that's the story in FX, bonds and equity in the commodity market, just to round things out for you. Up on crude, Brent up by 0.9%, up 0.75% on WTI. Brent $79.99 and WTI $69.16. Let's begin by getting you some top stories, shall we? Here is Charlie Bell.
Hi, thank you very much, Jonathan Ferrell. We begin with U.S. markets and two of the most followed trade proxies in the market, Caterpillar and Boeing. Both global companies are among the weakest in the Dow Jones Industrial Average today, potentially after cautious tariff commentary from Honeywell's earnings conference call. The company's executives are bracing for, quote, hundreds of millions of dollars in earnings pressure next year from the expanded tariff lists. Facebook has hired Nick Clegg, Britain's former deputy prime minister, to run its global lobbying efforts as governments around the world debate how best to regulate the social media giant. As leader of the Liberal Democrats, Clegg was also at the heart of the British government between 2010 and 2015, also a former member of the European Parliament who knows his way around the institutions of the European Union. Short seller Fahmi Qadir, who is betting against Tesla, says the carmaker faces risks to its supply chain because some vendors have not been getting paid, and others have been taking liens out against the company. Latest from the news desk. Jonathan Ferrow, back to you.
That was in an interview with Lisa Abramovitz and some bloke called Jonathan Ferrow a little bit earlier on Bloomberg TV.
There you go, making news.
Thank you very much. There is a Twitter war that I want to bring your attention to that I'm not sure how many people know about. It's Joe Weisenthal against. Do you know about this, Charlie? Because it's fantastic.
No, this is fill me in.
It's all right. You'll like this one. It's Joe Weisenthal against Nassim Taleb, and
yes,
it is the funniest Twitter war. And basically, what Joe does, and Joe can't be with us today because he's busy trolling Nassim. This is what Joe did. About a year ago, was it, Luke? About a year ago?
And
initially.
He's been doing it ever since he goes to airports.
So
now.
Let me just sort of run it through you for you. So this is Joe's initial tweet that starts everything off. There's a part of me that wants to read Nassim's new book about skin in the game, but I just don't think I can bear reading another airport business book. I think that's great. So Nassim, I don't know, he takes the bait. I've got no idea why. He replies, "What makes you label it as an airport business book, imbecile? Is it because I refuse to go on your show?"
Whoa.
To which Joe replies, "Oh, it just seemed like the kind of topic that businessmen would read on a flight." And then Joe's next tweet about 2 months later, "Hey, look what I just found at JFK Airport." And it was skin in the game. And then he goes, and every time Joe travels, he sends another message. So he gets to the airport at Terminal 5 at Heathrow and he's like, "Hey, look what book I found at Terminal 5. And here's the best bit. I believe Joe is on tour right now in Ireland. Is that right, Luke?
Yes, sent a picture from the Cliffs of Moher yesterday.
So he gets to a pub and he finds a pub called the Black Swan.
Oh,
he says
wow.
He takes a picture outside it saying, "Hi, Nassim Taleb." Honestly, this is so good. And Nassim replies. I've got no idea why.
Because he gets actually, I mean, he's a super bright guy.
Guys, breaking news in this. Breaking news.
Is he
in
replied?
It's worse than that. Nassim Taleb just 8 seconds ago blocked Joe on Twitter.
No, he didn't.
Blocked him on Twitter.
No, he didn't. It's
probably happened. He's probably listening to this. We probably caused the end of this. Jeez.
This is so, so good. Someone said, "Are you blocked yet?" And then someone replied, "I think he deadlifts, so it's cool." He does deadlift. Apparently he's a very powerful man.
Yes.
You don't want to get in a fight with him, Vince. I don't know what that's worth in this conversation, but just so you know.
I've studied martial arts for 15 years. I'm not afraid.
Did you? You should get some photos outside.
I'm a little out of shape right now.
Get some photos outside the Black Swan as well.
No, I leave that. The photos for Charlie Gasparino in the gym, I leave that to him.
Okay. All right.
He's probably going to be tweeting on me now. But
okay. Charlie, you want the final word on this?
No, I'm just thinking, given what Vince just said about 15 years of studying martial arts, I have to watch what I say now
about his girlfriend.
It actually goes back farther than that, Charlie, but only actively.
But in martial arts, you're taught to be calm, right?
That's my understanding.
The first lesson except in boxing for, is just discipline, except when they hit on your girlfriend.
except for the one I did 10 years ago, which was MMA in Philly.
Oh, really?
Which was like the real guys.
What was that like?
Listen, you know, in 6 months we'll get you your fight card. And I said, I'm gonna get my AARP card. I don't want a fight card.
Did you ever hear the story about the Conor McGregor kids? This is fantastic. So there's these two lads out on a late night, boozed up, and they start pretending to be Conor McGregor outside a pub in Ireland. So they're like play fighting, and one of them is actually pretending to be Conor McGregor. Then this big SUV pulls up alongside them, and they put down the window. Guess who's inside? And drives by as they're pretending to be Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor turns up. If you haven't seen this video, go on YouTube and watch it, because it's absolutely hilarious. And the two lads doing it obviously are like, what the? It is absolutely fantastic. Anyway, on to the real stuff. Charlie mentioning that interview a little bit earlier with the Tesla short seller, Fahmi Kadir, founder of Safket Capital, becoming very apparent to her, at least, that Tesla is having a hard time paying its bills. Take a listen to this.
What we saw this summer was finally vendors coming forward and saying that they're not getting paid by Tesla. We see suppliers are taking liens out against the company. We see some of these suppliers actually filing for bankruptcy. And this is a huge risk. We saw it happen with Valiant, but Valiant didn't face the same sort of supply chain issues that Tesla does today. Because a lot of Tesla's supply chain is single source. And we question the ability for Tesla to actually deliver on their promises to their customers when they're on the brink of potentially a massive supply chain disruption. We see very little contingency planning, and we also see executives from the supply chain department departing in recent weeks and months.
Fahmi runs a short-only hedge fund, aggressively intelligent, super, super smart quant on forensic accounting. But I do wonder what the value is in having a short in Tesla and what edge you get if you're at a short-only hedge fund. I think that's a question worth asking, Charlie. When 26% of the free float is short already, what are you offering your clients if you are also short too?
I don't have the answer for that. Luke Kawa is here. Maybe Luke has it.
Luke?
I'm tempted to pass the buck, but I think
Fahmi
is great. Her work on Valiant, incredibly meticulous. Also in the Dirty Money episode on Netflix, as long as we're doing shout-outs to shows, a great episode showing her work on Valiant. And I think more as, hey, she's she hasn't had this fun for a long time. Being right and loud on Tesla, I'm sure that's helpful in terms of raising capital. That might be one edge here.
You think that's what it could be, a marketing ploy? Well, should have asked her about it.
Also helps to be right, you know?
It does help to be right. She was certainly right about Valiant. Guys, great to have you with me. Vincent Signorella, Bloomberg's macro strategist, is going to stick with me. Luke Cower as well. Charlie Pellett, thank you very much, sir. You have a fantastic weekend. Next up on the program, we take it from Tesla here in New York to leverage loans and fixed income. The risky part of fixed income right now, apparently, seems to be doing okay. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferrow and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Still can't find Guy Johnson, so I think we need the old introduction until he comes back. I'm serious. He never told me. He took a day off. Who starts a new show and just takes a day off?
It's pretty impressive.
I know. I did it yesterday.
You started a new show?
This isn't a new show for you.
Well, it's not a new show for me, but it's a new partnership.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You know, so I was preparing for Chelsea Man U tomorrow morning. Just
oh boy.
To feel somewhat rested. You excited about that, Luke?
Excited is probably the wrong word.
Where is it?
That's a good question. I believe it's at Old Trafford.
So it's not Jose going home, if that is indeed his home.
Well, who knows where he's going? Jose going is kind of the headline.
Jose going is another story.
Is the headline I would like to read. And I've done, but yeah, we probably need a pretty bad result for that.
Okay. All right. Let's get to fixed income. Who would have thought it? The lowest rated US leverage loans are delivering the highest return so far this year. I think this is just remarkable. This is an area of fixed income for floating rates where demand is absolutely massive. And leverage loans have essentially maintained this lead over the performance of high yield bonds. And also, in terms of supply, the leverage loan market is now bigger than the high yield market in the United States. Vince, this has got the attention of the Federal Reserve. I know it's got attention of a lot of investors, not just because the returns are great, but also because the quality of this stuff coming to the market, it's getting a whole lot worse just in terms of the covenants that are usually come along with it. What are your thoughts right now on this space of fixed income?
Actually, talking to a friend of mine who is a treasurer of a bank here in the States, a major European bank, actually, I should preface that. And the conversation we had was that this is maybe on its last legs. The Fed has made it very clear they're going to put the screws to the market and push Fed funds rate through neutral. So that's upwards of 3%. The dot plot is pretty clear, and if the Fed does this, the average yield, I guess, on triple C's is about 7.25%. But you add in the cost of carry, and then the risk of the underlying securities as well, and this paper is probably not where you want to be going forward. The average cost of carry since 2002 is north of 1,000 basis points, and if you match in the funding for the 5 years, so we're now in neighborhood of levels that has historically seen a sell-off in these bonds. So I just caution people, they look really tasty right now, but going forward into 2019, if the Fed stays on the trajectory of raising through neutral, which it appears they want to go, we may be seeing the top in these markets.
Luke, it's a floating coupon. It's great when rates are rising because essentially it's not going to bite into your yield. That's why people want this stuff. But the quality of it is raising a lot of concerns.
Yeah, and the Fed talks about essentially risks to financial stability stemming from this. I like to keep it a lot simpler and just talk about the aspect that you were mentioning. Hey, we're in a rising rate environment. I look at leveraged loans as basically a risk from a device for transferring duration risk from investors to corporates and making the economy more interest rate sensitive. So I think we're kind of in this battle. The length of the cycle might be predicated by how long and how much companies can term out and deciding to continue to term out and, you know, the on what terms versus to continuing to feed this boom in leveraged loans.
Vince?
Again, I just as we're saying, I think we're, you know, this is distressed loan names, and I don't see how distressed loan names will continue to be attractive with another 100 basis points.
The argument sort of made against all of this is that if I've got to own something in fixed income, the recovery rates in loans last time around in the financial crisis were pretty decent. That's kind of the bullish argument. I don't know how bullish that is because we're talking about recovery rates at the end of the day. Also incredibly illiquid. Just in terms of how this stuff trades, if you speak to people in the market, we're still talking about an archaic way of trading some of this stuff. These loans can be essentially executed through fax because it's not bought like, say, high-yield debt. And it can take a month to clear, say. I mean, it's very difficult to actually get in, to get out of some of these trades in leverage loans.
A lot easier to get in than get out. That's the difficulty with it.
I imagine that's the case when the door is closed.
When the door starts to close, it's pretty much gets to be a very narrow space.
Guys, it's great to have you with me. Much more on that ahead on the program and ahead on Bloomberg Real Yield, 30 minutes dedicated to fixed income. That's around the corner. Luke and Vince, stay with me. You're listening to The Cable without Guy Johnson. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is The Cable with Jonathan Ferrow and Guy Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
Another Brexit headline. Here we go. UK is set to drop Brexit demand on Irish border to ease a deal. Some reporting coming from our colleagues here at Bloomberg. Let's get the latest, shall we? Vincent Signorella. No, I'm not going to do that to you.
Oh, thank you.
Cable firm up about a half of 1% to 130.
Tell the 100 day if you'd like to know that, 130.95.
Yeah, approaching 131. This is interesting. I don't know what the demand is, though. I'm trying to find out. But the Irish border demand, I mean, I really don't get it. Either it's important or it's not. You know, it's one or the other.
It's
important. I don't get it.
It becomes important until the EU pushes back and then it's like, it's okay.
Yeah, I just don't
you
get
know
it.
They're going to push this all out for another year, right?
Oh, yeah.
We're stuck with this for another year.
This is where this is going.
3 years.
That's where this is going. I think most people coming around to that view very slowly, whether you like it or not. Thought it was really interesting also, the commissioner for the EU, Mr. Pierre Moscovici, coming out a little bit earlier, essentially saying the EU doesn't want to get involved in the economic policies of Italy. What? What have we been doing for the last few months?
They want to get involved in everything.
I'm very confused.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is the euro started to rally on his comments because he said, essentially, we don't want to get involved in the politics as long as the Italians don't break the rules. 2.4% by definition is breaking the rules.
So from peak to trough in the Italian 10-year yield right now,
and there was
a 32 basis point swing.
And there was a report in a local paper, Il Foglio, which came out a couple hours ago, which is now adding to the euro's gains, that said, and it's a little vague of whether they actually quoted Di Maio and Salvini, or they're just kind of suggesting that the Italians are going to drop their deficit demands from 2.4 to 2.1%, which of course would be appease the EU and all this would go away, and the S&P would probably not downgrade next Friday, and Bob's your uncle, and everything's lovely.
So we're sub 350 on an Italian 10-year after being at 380 a little bit earlier in the session.
And the spread went from 340, I think, BTP bunds down to 310 last look at the close.
Yeah, for anyone that's sort of questioning whether we can get to that 4% line in the sand, I'm not saying whether we can or can't. I'm just saying that if we can do it rather quickly and when the market wants to.
Well, I'll tell you, the Italians are going to answer by letter on Monday afternoon, European time, about the demands from the EU. I'm not holding out much hope. What's said in this letter is going to appease the majority of the council.
So how do you feel about holding risk over the weekend right now? How do you feel about Friday
afternoon? I would be fading this with both
hands. Such a classic European crisis question, isn't it?
Yeah.
How does the market open on Monday? And this must be sorted out before the market opens on
Monday.
Well,
no, it won't, because it'll come in the afternoon. So it'll probably hit around, I would say, just before lunch, London time, just enough to drag everyone out of the pubs
here
at 11.
Some highlights for your week ahead. Tuesday, don't know who's attending anymore, but Saudi Arabia will be hosting the Future Investment Initiative, dubbed Davos in the Desert. Eurozone consumer confidence coming out Wednesday. The bank earnings in Europe start to come. This is going to be really interesting given the environment over in Europe at the moment. Deutsche Bank third quarter earnings Wednesday. Barclays third quarter earnings Wednesday. US Fed Beige Book coming out too. There's one for you, Luke Cower. Canada hosting the Ottawa Ministerial on WTO reform.
You've already missed the Bank of Canada next Wednesday. You've already
Bank of Canada coming
right over
that day too. But at the epicenter of trade issues at the moment, Canada seemingly. Thursday, more European bank earnings, UBS third quarter, Twitter, Alphabet, call it Google still, I just can't get the Alphabet thing. Third quarter earnings, Amazon as well. Thursday's a massive day for tech. An ECB rate decision as well, US jobless claims, durable goods orders, advanced goods trade balance, third quarter GDP in a mix too in the United States, another read of that. Guys, so much coming on. In fact, is that the first read, Luke, for third quarter GDP coming up next Friday in the States?
Didn't know that either. Yeah, like I'm.
There's a lot coming up next week.
Yeah, I think it's got to be tech earnings for me. I think that's got to be something that we look to try to stabilize risk appetite, because it happened in the first quarter earnings season where we were just getting these not good announcement to earnings that beat no matter what. Call it the high watermark factor. Call it whatever you want. And then Facebook kind of broke the spell then. After that, beats get rewarded nicely, things start to drift up, and you know, we ended up marching to fresh all-time highs about 4 months later. So you need to see tech trade better, and when I'm just looking at the market internals right now, every day has been, this week, has been a trade-off between value and momentum. Intraday, just swinging back and forth and back and forth. There's just absolutely no direction in this factor rotation.
There is always a narrative that goes along with the price action, and some narratives help explain things, help tell you how to position for stuff, and some narratives are just comfort to explain what is sometimes the unexplainable. And yesterday really got my attention, Vince, because we had this gap lower in risk assets in equities, and everyone tried to explain it. I heard some explanations like Saudi Arabia, and I thought, Saudi Arabia? Why was the oil price down if it was Saudi Arabia? And then I just thought, could it be fear of fear itself? Drew Mattis of MetLife actually sent me an email and basically said that this is a market just scared of being scared and getting scared about being scared. About being scared. And then the market goes down. I mean, like, it's very, very hard, Vince, to get an idea of what is driving the price action right now? What is it?
I think you're still looking at a combination of risk both from Europe and Asia. The cut of 1,000 cuts towards China, sorry to use a Japanese reference to China, but basically now enacting, wanting to step out of that postal agreement, which is going to raise shipping costs for Chinese companies. It's not just the small businesses, but businesses that are acting like small businesses. Chinese economy is deflating. They're down at around 6.5%. They were trying to move from the deleveraging of the space to get away from monetary policy stimulation. Now they have no choice. With the economy sliding more, we're going to see some more reserve rate requirement cuts.
Yeah.
We're likely to see the currency weaken towards 7. If we breach 7, that's going to get Washington instigated again. And this all plays into a negative risk sentiment.
Vincent Signoretta, it's been great to catch up with you.
Thank you.
And you, Luke. I'm going to run to TV. 30 minutes dedicated to fixed income coming up on Bloomberg Television. If you can't be with me, have a fantastic weekend. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio. This was The Cable. This is Bloomberg.